So I'm going to talk about closed form interpretation of neural network classifiers with symbolic regression gradients. Okay, so there are a lot of words in the title, and so I chose the title. So the title might be a bit misleading because this framework is much more general than what the title says. But I chose the title such that people who are just Googling papers like this have a few keywords that they can read. One is neural network classifiers, because symbolic regression is always used in the context of regression, obviously, and not classification. So you will see in the next couple of minutes that this framework is a lot more general than what the title suggests. But let's start. So interpreting a neural network is typically pretty hard. But if you ask the right questions, then it becomes a lot easier. And so the main content of what I do is I simplify or I reformulate the question of what it means to interpret a neural network to get a reasonable answer. And I hope I have structured the talk in a way that is very easy to understand and as short as possible. And if you have any questions, please ask, because during the talk, I smuggle in some intuition that some people don't have, but I try to make this intuition look like it is very natural without necessarily going into a deep mathematical framework explaining it. So I hope everything will be extremely low level, self-contained, extremely short, and I hope a few people will be as excited as I am about this framework. Okay, so let's start. What am I going to do? Oh, do you see my cursor?
Yeah.
Okay, nice. Okay, so what am I going to do? So I train a neural network to classify something, whatever it is. And I assume that there is some kind of a mathematical concept learned by the neural network in some form. And that concept is then used to classify some kind of data. And the interpretation process then reveals this kind of a mathematical concept in the form of an equation. And so what is important that I already said, so the framework is not limited to classification, but I will use examples of classification to show you how it works, and you can apply it to any neurons in any hidden layers, and you can simplify the process of symbolic regression itself. And there are a lot of limits, but the framework is a lot broader than just applying symbolic regression to interpret neural networks. So the first thing that I do is I explain the remaining words in the title. Then I'm going to explain the theoretical framework. The most important part of the theoretical framework is mathematically defining some equivalence class of functions that learn the same mathematical concept. So I will keep it short. In my paper, there's a lot of math, or medium amount of simple math developing this equivalence class. Here it will be pretty short. And based on this equivalence class, I will derive and present the explicit interpretation algorithm. And later I'm going to apply this interpretation algorithm to 7 different data sets. In the first 6 data sets, I will just give you examples that it is indeed possible to recover some symbolic concepts from these classifiers. And in the last experiment, I will give you some kind of an intuition how deep this interpretation goes, so that and this interpretation goes deeper than just replicating the same process of what the neural network has learned with symbolic classification. And everything that I will talk about is found in that paper, but I've not yet updated this paper to the newest form. So the last experiment that I present is not yet in this paper. So explaining the words in the title. So the first thing is, what are closed form equations? So closed form equations are similar to the equation that I presented before, are equations that can be written with some elementary building blocks. So you can see here all these different kinds of equations. Maybe it's a bit too small, but it doesn't matter. So arithmetic expression, polynomial expressions, algebraic expressions, closed form expressions, analytic expressions, and mathematical expressions. And then you have here a list of all the things that can be included in these sets of equations. And so I chose closed form expressions as the things that I perceive are human readable. If you find something else is more suitable to be human readable, you can add or subtract some kinds of these expressions, but adding some of these expressions might be a bit difficult. So for example, if we look here, we have a logarithm or an exponential function, which themselves are already complicated expressions that arise from more complicated mathematical operations that summarize if you view it as a Taylor series, it's like an infinite sum already. So depending on what you define as your elementary operations, you can define yourself a set of human readable equations that you can use to build this framework upon. And so what is important going forward is that all the building blocks of the equations are differentiable. And that's the only requirement. So now we know what closed form equations are. The next step is, what is an interpretation? So interpreting neural networks has a lot of different meaning in a lot of different contexts. And it's a huge field, it's an important field. And if someone comes and tells you what he has found a way to interpret this neural network black box, it could mean a lot of different things. So if we put it in a formal form, interpreting an artificial neural network means formulating a mapping between an abstract mechanism or encoding to a domain that a human can understand. And so in the sense of closed form equations, I assume we know some building blocks of these closed form equations. These are human readable, but I do not assume that we can understand the complexity in the natural form that arises from combining hundreds, thousands, millions of neurons or perceptrons in a neural network. So even if we can understand what a single perceptron does, as soon as we increase the number of perceptrons, the complexity grows through the roof, and the interaction between these perceptrons conceal the true functions that are human readable to us. So what are different classes of interpretations? So an interpretation can either be mechanistic or functional. So mechanistic means what kind of a mechanism is responsible for learning something as a very elementary building block, like, for example, understanding how a perceptron works, while functional is the interpretation on a functional level. So what result do all these interacting perceptrons produce? So if you can summarize all these millions of perceptrons as a closed form function, that is a functional interpretation. Then we have global versus local. So local interpretation is something that is an interpretation only for one single data point, versus global is an interpretation that is a uniform interpretation that holds true over all data points. So let me give you an example of local. If you backpropagate some, if you want to know what signal in an image caused a certain prediction, then you can backpropagate the from the loss function, and you get signals that point you to certain pixels that have a high impact on the classification. And for that, you need an input sample. So this is local. So this interpretation only holds true for one single input sample because it is attached to it. So it's a local interpretation. If you find a closed form function independent of the input, that's a global interpretation. Then the next step is, do you verify a concept that you think a neural network could have learned, or do you discover something completely new? So for example, if you know some physical mechanism and you want to check if your neural network is consistent with this mechanism, then it's a verifying interpretation. While if you do not know any physical mechanism that the neural network learns on a physical data set, and you want to look inside what the neural network has done to learn this new kind of a mechanism, this is discover. It's a discovering interpretation. And the last part is a low-level or a high-level interpretation. So a low-level interpretation is something that is very, very close to the input features. And as the neural network processes information, and as soon as this information gets closer to the output, high-level features combine several low-level features, typically in a highly non-linear form. And if a neural network can interpret, if you can interpret inside of a neural network features that arise in very later layers, this is a high-level feature interpretation. And for the purpose of this talk, what we do is we derive a functional, a global, discovering, high-level interpretation. Okay, let me just quickly go through the definitions of what I use as my neural network. So my neural network is, I have an input variable X, which gets passed through, in my case, two hidden layers consisting of these neurons and perceptrons. I denote the neural network as big F, as a function of the input, and it predicts some approximation to the true label Y. The neural network consists of all these layers, and what is important going forward is my neural network is written with a sigmoid output function, which is normally used for binary classification. And inside this sigmoid output function, so if I remove the sigmoid output function of a binary classifying neural network, then I'm left with something that I call the latent model, which is small f. So going forward, I will always have this distinction between large f and small f. The full neural network and the latent model where I have removed the last sigmoid activation function. So the neural network consists of all these layers, which are, as we know, defined as weight matrices applied to the activation vectors from the previous layer, plus some bias vector. They get passed through some nonlinear activation function or non-polynomial activation function, depending on how you look at the universal approximation theorem. The input is the activation of the first or a zeroist layer. And we train the neural network. Normally, with gradient descent and back propagation to adjust these weights and biases to minimize some kind of an objective function on a data set where we want the approximation. We want the neural network to make an approximation that holds true on what is now important, this data manifold D. So when we train, we don't just want to minimize the training error, but we also want to minimize the generalization error on the training manifold D. Okay, so now we have we know our neural network classifier, we know the closed form equations. How do we express human readable functions? So human readable functions in the sense of these closed form equations are represented by these symbolic regression trees. So these trees encode a function, the function that we see here, in these nodes that are connected in this tree. And so the symbolic regression algorithm, or the search algorithm that I use to search through the space of human readable functions, is interpretable machine learning for science with PiSER and symbolic regression JL. I'm mostly using the backend, the symbolic regression JL library, which has some features that I require to efficiently implement the algorithm, which are non-standard. That is why I'm using this library. I'm going to explain later what these features are, but let me now briefly explain what these nodes are and what happens. So if we train a neural network, we train it with backpropagation. In the case of symbolic regression, we use a genetic algorithm that evolves these nodes. And so what happens, you start with one single node of the tree, which gets randomly initialized, and this genetic algorithm mutates this initial node into four different possible nodes. So each of these nodes can then contain binary operators that, so if a binary operator pops up, you immediately get two subnodes, and this binary operator combines the input from two subnodes. A binary operator can be a plus, minus, and so on. If you have, so another building block are floating point numbers that get optimized with a gradient-based algorithm themselves. So in addition to a set of binary operator, you have an infinite set of floating point numbers. You also have nodes that encode the input variables, here x1 and x2, and you also have unary operators, for example, sine functions, exponential functions, that in contrast to the binary operators, only have one argument. So binary operators get these two leaf nodes, while a unary operator only gets one leaf node. And so this genetic algorithm evolves the tree to optimize the some kind of a loss function. Typically, you also use a mean squared error loss function, like in neural network-based regression. And you optimize this tree with a certain hyperparameters, tree depth, complexity, and then you find a function that hopefully approximates your symbolic regression problem. So this is symbolic regression, but we want to interpret neural network classifiers or anything in neural networks that is not regression. So let us discuss the theoretical framework or the idea. So an artificial neural network learns concept in a highly elusive and convoluted manner. So when a neural network learns some kind of a function, this function gets encoded into this neural network in a stretched way. You have all these permutations of neurons and symmetries. So different neural networks can be transformed into each other and still encode the same function. If you learn, if there's a neural network that learns, for example, the energy, then one layer might contain some kind of a weird form of the energy, like some higher order polynomial of the energy, which is still the same physical concept, but the neural network stretches all of this. So if you have a neuron with a rectified linear unit, I hope everyone knows that. So it's like you can just multiply one layer while dividing the previous layer by the same factor. So you have all these symmetries that just conceal concepts that are learned by a neural network. And now the question is, if a neural network learns a concept that can in principle be written in a human readable form, is it possible to reveal the closed form concept while ignoring any uninterpretable transformations? And in order to think about it, the way I formalize it, I put this large neural network into the form of, so I remove the activation function, which gets clearer later why I do that. And I separate out some kind of an uninterpretable transformation from a closed form decision function. So if we imagine that there is, we look at one specific neuron. In this case, it is the output neuron. And this output neuron encodes the function that we want in some kind of a weird way. Is it possible to remove the weird uninterpretable transformation so we are only left with the closed form decision function? And the way this will work going forward is, so I define an equivalence class of all functions that contain the same information. So if the neural network learns some kind of, learns to extract the energy from some kind of a physical sample, then the energy squared is exactly the same function. It contains exactly the same information. The e to the power of the energy, like what you have in your in a Boltzmann factor, it's still the same object. So the concept does not change by all of these transformations. So I define this manifold or this equivalence class. I define this equivalence class of all functions that contain the same information. And the neural network will be somewhere that is normally not readable. So the way, the idea behind interpreting the neural network is now not interpreting the neural network directly, but I define a space of human readable functions that is defined by the symbolic regression search space, which is this blue here. And I try to intersect, I find an intersection between the space of human readable functions and the space that, and the equivalence class of all functions that contain or encode the same information as the neural network. So I will not directly interpret the neural network, but I will interpret the concept that is encoded in the neural network while throwing away everything that just conceals this information. So in the end, we will be left with a function that is human readable and contains the same information as the neural network. And there might be several of these functions. So as I said, you could find the equation that describes the energy, or it could be you find the equation that describes the energy squared, an order parameter, or the absolute value of an order parameter squared, as all the same concept, they're just formulated in a different way. And so typically, when you search through the space of human readable functions with your symbolic regression algorithm, you will first identify the most simple way to describe your physical concept. Okay, so now we have built the intuition. Now we can define this equivalence class of functions. So this is, so in the next two or three slides, there will be the whole mathematical background. So this is the most complicated part of the whole talk. So a function f of x contains the full information about a certain quantity g of x. So f already reminds you of this latent neural network, and g already reminds you of that closed form concept. So a function f of x contains the full information about a certain quantity g of x if g of x can be faithfully reconstructed from x. And conversely, if f of x only contains information from g of x, it is possible to reconstruct f of x from the knowledge of g of x. So in mathematical terms, it just means that there exists an invertible transformation such that you can transform g of x into f of x and backwards for every single data point x. So if you have a one-dimensional input variable, this kind is kind of trivial and not necessary, because all the functions are then more or less the same. But if you go to a higher dimensional input space, this becomes extremely useful, as we will see in the future. So here we can see a picture that if you can apply any invertible one-dimensional transformation to an output neuron to transform it into some kind of another function, all these functions are seen as equivalent in the sense of this equivalence class. So let's look at it. So we will we will build our intuition of how a neural network learns from that slide. So we are now trying to understand where what I just discussed on a previous slide comes into play when we train a neural network. Okay, so let's start from zero. We have a data set that contains two features, and we train a data set that contains two features, and the data set is separated in two classes. So on that plot, we see the data set separated into two classes. So we have the orange class and the light blue class. The data points are separated by a decision boundary, x1 squared plus 2x2 squared equals 1. So this is this red ellipse with a bit of noise. And a neural network is then trained to separate, to classify between these two classes and separate the data according to this decision boundary. And if we evaluate the neural network and we compare it to the function that determines the decision boundary, we get this plot. So if we are at a location in this plot for a data point where this function evaluates to a certain value, for example, if we're here, this function probably evaluates to 0.7. So then the neural network prediction will be zero for class zero. If this function, if we are here, this function evaluates to a value which is larger than one, then we will probably be somewhere here. And the neural network, the blue curve, evaluates to one, as we expect from a binary classifier. If we are directly of the at the decision boundary, then this decision function would evaluate to 0.5. Okay, check. So that makes sense. So now let us remember this latent model that we get from removing the sigmoid activation function from the full neural network. So if we compare what the latent model or the last output of the neural network without the sigmoid activation function yields, it is this curve. And we see that this curve is extremely well correlated with this decision function. But we also see it is not this decision function, but it's somehow tilted and deformed. I do not know what that function is. It might be some kind of a weird mathematical formula that I cannot express in terms of a closed form equations like a sine or an exponential or a polynomial, but it is an almost linear function, but it's still a nonlinear function that might be impossible to express in very simple terms. So where is the function phi that we just defined before? The function phi is exactly that. So it's the function that maps between the concept g of x and the latent model f. So this is this uninterpretable transformation that I've been talking about all these slides before, just visualized. Okay, so let us define this equivalence class in mathematical terms. So define the equivalence class of functions that contain the same information as g of x. So all the functions that contain the same concept g of x. So we have this equivalence class hg equals the set of all differentiable functions on that data manifold 2R, and the set contains all of these functions for which there exists an invertible transformation phi that is also continuously differentiable, for which this function can be obtained by applying this invertible transformation phi on this concept g of x. Now, if we look at this equivalence class, it seems pretty unhandy to access it from a computational perspective. And now the question is it possible to rewrite this equivalence class to make it computationally accessible so we can calculate, we can efficiently calculate the intersection between the space of human readable functions and this equivalence class? And the way we do that is we calculate the gradient with respect to the input. So if we look at the gradient, so we calculate the gradient of this function. We know this function can be expressed as some weird transformation applied to the concept g of x. So we calculate the gradient with respect to the input equals first derivative of this function according to the chain rule times the gradient of that function itself. And we observe that the only thing that the derivative of phi does, it stretches the gradients. So at every single point, at every single data point, these gradients are parallel. So this lets us redefine the equivalence class, or formulate a new equivalence class. Hg equals all functions for which the gradients, the normalized gradients, are the same. The normalized gradients of f are the same as the normalized gradients of g, except when both of the gradients are zero for all data points on the data manifold. And so it's easy to convince ourselves that h tilde is contained in hg, but we want it the other way around. We want that for every function f in hg, that there exists this invertible transformation. So it's easy to define the second equivalence class, which is also computationally accessible. But the problem is now showing that if starting from the second equivalence class, hg, that for every function f in there exists an invertible phi such that f can be transformed from the concept g of x. And I will not do that here. You can read that in my paper. It's a lot of very basic elementary math with a few tricks. And that allows us to show that under certain conditions, that both of these equivalence classes are the same. And this is it. So this was the hardest math that we will discuss. So now we have discussed all the intuition that we need to just formulate the interpretation algorithm. So in order to find a function that contains the same information as the neural network and is human readable, we calculate the intersection between the second equivalence class HG and the symbolic regression search space. And how do we do that in practice? So we have defined this second equivalence class with these normalized gradients. Okay, let's quickly look again at it again. So we have these normalized gradients here, which are computationally accessible. And we fit a symbolic regression model to replicate the normalized gradients of a latent neural network. So we, in order to interpret the neural network, we look at these black arrows, which are the normalized gradients of this function g of x, or of the neural network, since they are the same, since both of them are in the same equivalence class. And that's all we do. We train a neural network, calculate the normalized gradients, fit a symbolic regression model, take a symbolic regression model, calculate the normalized gradients, and fit the normalized gradients to the gradients of the neural network. Okay, so let's put that in an algorithm. So step one of three is train a neural network for binary classification. So we have some kind of a data set. We train the neural network on that data set, and we remove the sigmoid activation function from the fully trained binary classification neural network F. Now we have two models, one full neural network F with the sigmoid activation function, and another one, which is the latent model small f without the sigmoid activation function. Good. Second step, we obtain the gradients of the latent model. So there are a few non-intuitive steps in there. So in addition to the labeled data set, we add an unlabeled data set because we do not need the labels calculating or determining if something is in the equivalence class. We only need the gradients. So we can add much more data. We can sample more data. We can perturb training data. Just feed it into the neural network. Because for every data point, we need to calculate the gradient anyway. So we do not use the neural network prediction in any way, except here in the second step. So what we do is we only select data that is reasonably close to the decision boundary. So we throw away data points that where the neural network is extremely certain that it is in one class or in another class. So in practice, extremely certain means delta is 10 to the minus 4, something like this. So it does not need to be close to the decision boundary. It's just because if you're in regions where the neural network is certain, then the neural network does not train as easily anymore because the gradients get suppressed by the neural network training. So we don't want to be in this regime. Then the calculating the gradients becomes a bit inaccurate. But calculating the gradients is exactly what we do. So we calculate the gradients of the neural networks with respect to the input. And I mean, we know neural networks are trained with gradient descent backpropagation. So obtaining gradients is optimized and so natural to do in neural networks anyway. Now we just do it for the inputs instead of the weights, which is the same as you do when you generate adversarial examples anyway. So it's extremely optimized to get these gradients of the model. The last step is we normalize these gradients and we output this new data set that is larger than the initial data set. And the label is the gradients GF. And the last step of the algorithm is we just fit the symbolic model to have the same normalized gradients. So we have this gradient data set that we just defined in the second step. We initialize a symbolic regression model. It can be any model, any function you want. So it does not need to be symbolic regression, but in my case, I use symbolic regression. So I initialize the symbolic regression model. I apply this genetic evolvement step in each case. In each step, I calculate the gradients of the symbolic of the function that is represented by the symbolic tree. I normalize it and I calculate the mean squared error between the normalized gradients of the symbolic tree and the latent neural network. And that's it. Okay, after all these steps, we obtain several symbolic regression models T, and hopefully one of them will replicate the concept that the neural network has learned in a symbolic form. So now that we've discussed the algorithm, we can apply the algorithm to several different data sets to recover the concepts that a neural network has learned to classify data. And I have applied it to seven different data sets. Each of these data sets are characterized by these decision function. So we already saw a plot for data set one, which is this ellipse, where data points where x1 squared plus 2x2 squared greater than 1 is in one class and smaller than 1 is in another class. And the same holds true for all the other data sets. Experiment 7 is a bit different because the features are correlated, and I will discuss that on a separate slide. But let me first just apply this interpretation algorithm to neural networks that classify these data sets. So we train a neural network, we calculate these gradients, we fit a symbolic regression model, and the output of these symbolic regression models are these Pareto fronts. So they collect different equations with decreasing mean squared error and increasing complexity. So you see here we have a very small, short equation with a low complexity and a relatively high mean squared error. So this is log scale. And we have a more complex equation that has a very small mean squared error, but is most likely too complex to be the true function that describes the concept. And so what you typically do, you go through the list of these functions. I mean, the search space of symbolic regression is enormous, and it tells you like 10 or 15 different functions, candidate functions, of which one might be the function that describes your concept. Typically, what happens is where the Pareto front shows a very steep change, that is where you find your function. But it's not always the case. Sometimes your function is somewhere else in the Pareto front. And you can do some dimensional arguments to verify that the function that the symbolic regression algorithm yields makes sense. So even if you have 10 functions here, you can make a few quick checks to verify which of these candidate functions is the right one, and then you have found your concept. So in the first experiment, we explicitly recover that concept in the third equation. In the second experiment is found in this equation. So I do not know if you can read it, but that equation is a bit shorter than that equation. And I made it so that if you square that equation, you approximate this function. So I tried to confuse the interpretation process, and what it chose was the approximation, which is a lot simpler to describe that function. In the third experiment, we can again find the exact function here. In the fourth experiment, we find the exact equation here. In the fifth experiment, we find the exact equation here. And in the sixth experiment, we find a first order Taylor approximation of that function here, which is already pretty complex because it contains six variables, and we allow for all these exponential functions and sine functions to be learned. So that is normally a problem where symbolic regression algorithms have problems learning it. But in this case, it still makes sense to have this first order Taylor approximation, which I still think is a good result. But the most important or the most interesting experiment is the seventh experiment, where if we look at the formula, so there are two strategies that you can use to classify the data correctly. So it's that the product between x1 and x2 and the product of x3 and x4 both are greater than one in one class and smaller than one in another class. So you can now just use one of the features to correctly classify the data. These features are correlated. And so what you can do is you can use a symbolic regression model as a symbolic classification model with appropriate adjustments, and then learn what and then replicate what the neural network has done. And then you get some kind of a symbolic classification Pareto front that selects one of the features and classifies the data correctly. So, but what I want to say with this slide is, this is not interpreting a neural network. This is just trying to replicate what a neural network does. My interpretation framework can interpret what a neural network does. So my interpretation framework finds that the neural network learns a combined feature of these two instead of just one. And here you can see a correlation plot between these different strategies. So the symbolic classification model, the results of the symbolic classification models are the green and blue dots, which are here and here. And you see that the correlation between the neural network and the blue or green dots is not very large. However, the correlation between what my interpretation framework told us what the neural network has learned is here, it is extremely good, and here it is good, but you see these outliers here. But this is the closest form, the closest match to a closed form equation of what the neural network has learned in the sense of interpreting a neural network and not just replicating what a neural network is doing. So let me reframe that a bit. So for example, if you classify between humans and dogs, so you can take the fur color as one feature, or you could use the presence of a tail as a feature. And if you want to replicate what the neural network has done, you can choose one of these features, and it does not necessarily need to be what the neural network has learned. So that is kind of the same problem that I addressed in this slide. So what I'm saying is my framework is a true interpretation of the neural network. It is not just replicating something that yields the same results of the neural as the neural network. Okay, so let's come to the conclusion. So it is possible to find closed form interpretations of neural network classifiers or for any other neuron in any hidden layers or latent spaces using this framework. And if you have some kind of a network where you want to try this, please let me know. Would be really cool to have some examples where this works. Okay, so that's it. Thanks, guys.
Questions?
Very nice work, Sebastian. I have a question. So basically, you are trying to find the closed form of the interpretation of the neural network by matching the gradient of the two functions. So effectively, what I want to ask is, when does it fail? So I guess what I'm asking is that the two equivalent classes are defining the H and H2 dot. When do they not equal?
Okay, so the main assumptions are that your neural network is a continuously differentiable, so one times continuously differentiable function, and your data manifold is simply connected. So these are the two main ingredients that are most likely violated in machine learning contexts. So the not simply connected is, so for example, if you have a dog, an image of a dog, and you just rotate the image of a dog, it's probably and get a different image. So I do not know if is it simply, I don't know, maybe it is simply connected, maybe it's not. If you have a category, if you have categorical data, you don't embed it in the in this any space of real numbers, so it's also not simply connected in the sense what you need to define your curves for this equivalence proof. And another case that is pretty common is if you have non-differentiable functions or piecewise differentiable functions. So for example, if you build your neural network with ReLU activation functions, so for everyone who knows, so ReLU functions are these functions that are zero below zero and x above zero, so it's max zero comma x, and this function is not differentiable at zero. So what you see is, if you would perform this interpretation procedure, you would get computational artifacts at where a ReLU activation function is, where the input of a ReLU activation function is close to zero. And so that's how I started, and it didn't really work. And it is because since inputs of ReLU activation functions are very often close to zero, you often get close to the regime where the function is non-differentiable, even though it's just one single point, and that completely destroys this interpretation framework or makes it extremely so there are a lot of computational artifacts that make it extremely noisy and not very robust. So your data set can screw you over, and if you choose the wrong activation functions, they screw you over. So so make sure your activation function is continuously differentiable, and you do not and if you suppress the gradients like a sigmoid activation function, you need to remove the outliers. That's basically it.
And have you ever tried on the neural network that classifies, for example, basis of a transversal eye model? Because I've seen that the examples are all on the a mathematical function. Have you tried on more physics?
Maybe when we meet next time, with this autoencoder stuff, I wanted to propose something like this. But how I got into this interpreting neural networks was 7 years ago, when I interpreted one of these networks, and what was different there was finding a strategy that allows you to decompose information from thousands of input features. So if you're on a lattice and you have a convolutional network, you still operate on on 1,000 or 10,000 different spin, depending on your lattice size, or even if it's just 100, that number is too large for symbolic regression. So you need to reduce the complexity of the problem to make it simpler for your symbolic regression algorithm or whatever other regression algorithm or interpretation framework you use. So yes, I did that, and it works, but I could only make it work with linear or polynomial functions of a very low degree.
Thank you.
Thank you. This was an interesting talk, Sebastian. So one of the things that I noticed was I thought, like, at the start, I thought, like, it's going to be, when you explained the algorithm, I thought it's going to be, like, all-encompassing. And it seems like it is, except for maybe a couple parts, at least for me. One was that, so when you were in the algorithm, when you were creating the data set for, like, the gradients from the data set, you said in step two, I think, you said when you're creating, you have your data set, training data set, plus your artificial, whatever, rest of them. And then you say you weed out the ones that are not around the decision boundary. That's what I thought you said. And
I only use data points where the full network. So only data points close to the decision boundary. And close is a very loose word, because in my case, the only data points that I got rid of are where the classification in either faces was where the phase prediction was 99.99% one face or the other face. So that's what I mean with close to the decision boundary.
Yes, and so this would be like, what if you had more than two classes? What if it wasn't zero and one? What if you had like 10 classes and your accuracy will, first of all, probably decrease a little bit. I mean, depending on how deep your neural network is, I guess. Then you have to also manually sit down and weed out. Is it not like possible to just have, because the gradient thing, I think, is general, like the equivalence class is always like when you have a mapping phi, you go from a function G to function F, that always works, and you always have the normalized gradients are equal. Can't you just like keep all the data? Is that not a good idea? Did that not work? Like what happens if you just keep all the data and try to find a symbolic, I guess it's more noisy, but then try to fit a function G with your symbolic regression or many functions of G's.
Okay. There's a lot of content and context. So the first thing is, if you have multiple classes, then yes, it would work the same way, but it could become more difficult. So the functions that you learn could become a bit more difficult. I mean, you, instead of having one output, so if you have multiple classes, every class will be its own binary classification model, right?
Yeah, it's either okay. In that, or it's not in that.
Yeah, and so you can interpret each single neuron, each single output neuron, exactly the same way, but you do not remove the sigmoid function, but the softmax activation function. So in that sense, it would work exactly the same way, but the functions might become a bit more difficult. So for example, if you have just circles, so radius smaller than one, between one and two, and greater than one. So just this problem. And you want to figure out the decision boundary for class two, which is between these two circles. So it needs to combine these two functions, which is possible. And I also did that in my example, but the functions get more complicated. So that is one thing. And with the interpretation close to the decision boundary, it is, one argument is that if you go far away from the decision boundary and your neural network gives you very accurate classifications, then the gradient descent algorithm, or any gradient gradients that you calculate, will get suppressed by the tails of get exponentially suppressed by the tails of the sigmoid function. So they become very inaccurate. So that's why I do not want to have them. So that they screw you up during the training process, and they screw you up during the extraction of the gradient process. So that's why I don't want them.
When
so
we get close to the the accuracy for them, when it becomes 0.999, isn't the gradient like very also close to zero? So even if you include those, you can probably, instead of just weeding it out manually, you can just say, oh, if the gradient is like within like a, I don't know, very very good approximation, is very close to zero, then you can still have them, but they don't really matter because they're close to zero. Isn't that what happens? Maybe I'm
okay. Wait, let me get. So it is not because I'm not looking at the neural network, but I'm looking at the latent model. So I'm basically inverting the sigmoid function, which means if I invert the, if I calculate the gradient of this inversion, then I would get a very strong correction signal. So I get, so.
Oh yeah, after sigmoid is supposed to zero.
So I calculate the gradients of this latent model where I already removed the sigmoid. So you could think about applying an inverse sigmoid function to the final neural network. And if you apply an inverse signal, then that corrects for the exponential suppression by applying exponential increase or enhancement.
But I'm still thinking.
Cancels out. You don't get a zero signal. You get a finite signal that consists of two competing exponential factors. One that is suppression, and one that is a magnification. And that's not what is computationally stable.
Before you apply the inverse sigmoid, like the entire fully trained, like the function, the big F. And if you calculate the gradient for that, for the very accurate, like if you're in one phase or the other, the gradient is equal to zero, correct? At some point after the training, your gradient is very close to zero, isn't it?
Wait.
It's not going to move around anymore.
I don't understand. Why should the gradient be close to zero?
Because if you're not around the decision boundary and you're far away from it, and like the prediction goes to, let's say, one outside the decision boundary, it doesn't change that much afterwards, right? The gradient should go to zero. It shouldn't move around. At least that's what I think.
So the thing is, if you a neural network for binary classification tries to classify your data in categorical form. Let's assume we don't have noise for what we are currently thinking through, because that screws you over. We don't have noise. And what happens in the neuron before the classification is it tries to get pushed through the sigmoid activation function such that it is as close as possible to a threshold function that is binary. So in order to replicate that, how it would do, it would stretch the function as far as it can computationally possibly be until machine precision, so that you're getting as close as possible to one or zero after putting it through the sigmoid. So that means the latent model F should predict for each of these classes either a value that is close to machine precision infinity or close to machine precision minus infinity. So if there is no noise, you could, in principle, if you train for infinitely long, and you would go even beyond this exponential suppression, you would eventually end up with a latent model that predicts plus or minus infinity up to machine precision.
Yes, but the gradient after the entire model is close to zero, right? After the sigmoid.
So if you include the sigmoid, the gradients with respect to the input at regions where the model either predicts close to zero or close to one, is in these cases the gradient is close to zero. Exactly. Yeah.
So you can use that for the default model to automatically read out the data. Like instead of just going and seeing which data are close to the decision boundary, or putting in or put like a definition, a kind of subjective definition on how accurate your data is, you can say if my gradient is like within, I don't know, machine precision, maybe not, but it's because your data is probably noisy, but if it's very close to zero, I guess very close, it's a bit subjective, but I think it's less subjective than like reading it out with your eye. And then saying it's, if it's less than 10 to the power of minus 50, 40, throw them out.
So I understand what you mean, and that might work. So I believe what you're saying is correct. However, there could also be other reasons that are not computational artifacts or that are physical that cause your gradient to be zero in principle.
But I think like you probably, like you can also say if I end up with let's say 10,000 data points that the gradient, whose gradient is not zero, I'm fine. Like, you know, maybe some of the decision boundary, some of the boundaries data set, data points, you lose them because of that, maybe. But still, I mean, you have enough data, so who cares?
Yeah, I agree with you. So it might make sense, but there might be the small subtlety that there might be some physical reasons for a gradient that is zero somewhere else in the data set, which might not be bad, but maybe it's even better what you're suggesting, right? Maybe could be you could be right. But all I'm saying is that I would need to think about it, because there might be some other things that might make it not as ideal to choose it that way.
Yeah, fair enough.
But it's still a good thought. I mean, you're right. It could very well work. Yeah, I don't need that.
Right. Thank you. This was I just want to say, like, this was not only a great talk but also a great explanation. I think if I didn't know anything about anything essentially, if I started from the start listening to the talk, I would have understood like 99% of the, which is very rare in a lecture. So thank you.
I think essentially the goal is actually kind of, you can imagine, like, we are actually just trying to like search in that space to like find the something to fit the the manifold of the decision surface, right? That's exactly why, like, it, once like the area is not simply connected, like things just load like loaded, and also why we should like always ignore those like, very close to zero or very close to one. If you include them, like your modeling sampling will be just too large, and you will see like no useful information at all.
Sorry, I lost you somewhere, but you didn't ask a question, right?
I'm trying to actually, can tell if I'm like saying it correctly. So in the very beginning, I think like essentially we are trying to like modeling the manifold of the decision surface, like between one and zero, right? The transition surface. So that is like, I feel that is the reason why once you're like your network is not like simply connected anymore, nothing worked at all. Also like, that's also the reason why we should not like include those like very extreme data points. Do you think this argument is correct or not?
As in, my comment to this is that it doesn't seem like he's removing the points because the gradient is zero. It's actually that it is very flat, right?
Yeah.
And flatness does not equal gradient zero, because gradient can be locally zero, but not flat in that locally, because it can be like, it just transitions across zero. But then like, when you cut off the, as in when he's cutting off the points outside of the, as in, outside of the decision boundary, it is actually because that the points there are all locally flat. So as you evaluate the function, is zero everywhere, like almost everywhere, like locally.
But then you calculate the gradient as well.
Oh, but you calculate a gradient at a point. You do not calculate the gradient across all the points.
Yeah, no, but if you calculate the gradient at a point, what's the problem with saying if the gradient of that point is zero?
Let me briefly tell you, interrupt. So the gradient of the neural network is zero here and here. So we have the sigmoid function that suppresses everything, but the gradient of the latent function is not zero at these points.
Yeah. I mean, we already like went through this, but yeah.
As in what he's proposing is a way to, algorithmically kind of get rid of the
outside decision boundary or very much inside. And I mean, if you use the full net neural network, then the gradient very far away is very close to zero. So you can't get rid of a lot of the data.
No, but as in, it's not the case the other way around. It's not that the gradient is, as in you're saying that far away, the gradient is zero. But then what you need is that, it's the inverse statement, is that when you're, is that gradient equals zero implies that you're far away, but that's not the case.
Okay, since we already started, to steer you in the right direction of what you're thinking, so when you train a neural network for binary classification, the only region where your neural network needs to be accurate is the decision boundary. So if your neural network becomes completely inaccurate to learn that decision function far away from the decision boundary, it does not matter because it does not affect the decision boundary. So that means the training signal that you get while you train on these outliers that are already characterized correctly is small. So that's a different perspective on that sigmoid suppression. So it's just that even without the sigmoid, it is natural for a neural network to not receive a training signal in regions that are already classified correctly. So it's not necessarily only the sigmoid. It is also inherent to the classification process. And it is kind of a miracle that we get that correlation of the neural network, of the latent model, to the true underlying concept, even in regions far away from the decision boundary. So that is something I still do not fully understand why this works, because only through that happening is it possible to recover the concept. If that would not be happening, I would not be able to recover the concept. And I mean, if someone can tell me why this function gets replicated even far away from the decision boundary, please let me know. That would be interesting.
Because basically you are remodeling these, like that decision surface, right? So you should never like sample like two extreme data point. The only useful information is always to run that like a boundary, and your search space is always like those like perfect function that like human can read, understand. So they are very limited. So you never like have any ability to like model those like very weird shape. Once you include those like very far away data points, your objective like geometry will be too bizarre to model with those like functions in your space.
We have another question.
I'm not sure whether this is a question or a comment, and I'm also not sure whether I quite understood what the issue in the discussion is. But, Ray, whether or not it's a good idea to sample far away from the decision point, usually when you have machine learning, there's some kind of random component, accept or reject going on. If you sample far away from the decision boundary, right, you're not learning very much about the decision that you're trying to make. And all you're doing is creating an opportunity for more noise to come in, right? It's not selective for a good distinct discriminator. It's just opening the door to random noise, right? It's like genetic drift, right? If you don't select for, you've got like fish living in a cave, right? There's no selection. Having good eyesight, they eventually lose their eyesight. If you're far away from a decision boundary, you're not gaining anything from training. You're just opening the door to more random noise. I'm also bothered by taking stuff about, oh, well, you know, we have a zero gradient, therefore we can ignore something. There's an awful lot of stuff in physics where you define what you're looking for by the zero gradient, like least action principle, like saddle point approximations, like maximum entropy methods, and all the rest of it. So I think it's dangerous to say, oh, right, well, my gradient is zero, therefore I'm going to ignore it, because it may create and lock you into algorithms which cannot handle a large class of cases.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant when we were discussing with Ali about his suggestion. So I think his suggestion is good, but I also think exactly what you're saying, that you need to be careful about doing it. It could even be computationally much more efficient, but I have not tested it.
Yeah, but so, I mean, also applications are kind of hand wavy right now. I mean, I'm not saying that getting rid of the gradient because it's zero is necessarily going to work, but I thought it was an interesting thought, one thing. And also, I mean, if we can't mathematically show that, like, at some point, other points, the gradient is equal to zero and we're going to get into trouble, then sure. But I mean, right now, this is just like a hand wavy argument on both sides.
Yeah. No, but yes. So I think it's good to explore it, but it's also important to keep in mind that there might be problems to keep in mind. But I'm all in favor for doing things and asking questions later. But
another second order issue is, you want a theory to be simple and explanatory powerful, you need it to be simple and preparably easy to calculate. So you would expect to put something in your algorithm that selects for simple theories. Right? Now, if you sample far away from a decision boundary, all sorts of really bad theories will give you something that matches that data point because it's nowhere near the decision boundary.
So the simple selecting simple functions is in the symbolic regression algorithm. So they are ordered by complexity. So you get the simple functions first, even if they have a worse mean squared error, you will get them first, and then you get a list of more complicated equations that might overfit the data, and that's how you see the simple functions first.
But that's another reason to avoid sampling too far away from the decision boundary, because you're going to get problems with, you know, there's all sorts of really bad functions, right, that will give you the right answer far away from the decision point, and you don't want to get locked into those. If there's any kind of canalization effect in your update rule, like, that can get you into trouble quite fast.
I think I have a comment on your statement. What he was proposing was not to sample far away from the decision boundary. What he's actually proposing is a mechanism for determining what point is far away from the decision boundary.
And get rid of it.
Yeah.
Having a zero gradient, and the trouble is that there's an awful lot of theories which are defined as find the case where this thing is zero, like, for example, path integrals, maximum entropy methods, least action principle. Right, you look for a derivative being zero. This is how your theory works.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't exactly agree on this context, but because the examples you gave, I don't think I'm not saying that it might not be possible for here to have zero gradients, but and them being relevant, but I think, like, because we have, like, in other problems, gradient being equal to zero is important. I don't think it's necessarily a thing that is going to happen here, and I think actually it's very unlikely. At least for me, I have to have a reason to believe there is a zero gradient around the decision boundary, and the other way around, because what around the decision boundary is hard. Things are hard to learn, and the more you train it, still is the thing is uncertain, because you get closer, gain more precision. And for me to find zero gradients around the decision boundary is just, I can't believe it unless someone actually shows it to me. And they have to have an interpretation of why there's a zero gradient as opposed to why there isn't. So, like, my default is the gradient around the decision boundary is not zero, and anywhere else is. Like, the further away you get from the decision boundary, the closer to zero your gradients are going to be, after you have properly trained it for, like, quite a few epochs. Like, the other way around is kind of unbelievable to me in this context. And, like, I want a reason for that, actually.
Well, I mean, you've heard of things like least action principle.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean,
yeah,
you can't.
Okay. I think I can get you both very quickly. One is my interpretation algorithm relies on that the function that the neural network learns contains the concept even away from the decision boundary. So I need, so I evaluate gradients also far away from the decision boundary, but reasonably far away from the decision boundary. And for example, if we have the ellipse, the x1 squared plus 2x2 squared, if we evaluate that function at zero, we have a zero gradient, which is part of the function. So it is a zero. There is a zero gradient naturally in the data set. It is far away from the decision function, but I also fit reasonably far away from the decision function. I do not know if the point x1, x2 equals zero is reasonably close to the decision function according to this delta exclusion principle that I used, but it could very well be within the data set that I used to apply the symbolic regression. So it could be physical, and this is an example. Even it's not an
amazing example though, is it? Because like
we're done.
Okay.
Not because it's not fascinating, but because you guys are cutting in your free food time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Sebastian. It's the best talk of the year, right? Let's give a guy a round of applause.